dignify your fellow workers. I'm sure they'll make space for you to sit with them. We have five working groups in different contexts and configurations, and some development happened in the choreography during the afternoon. We have until 5 to 6. I'll hand back to Eve for some concluding comments. I think the advertising break will probably happen, and then the weather, and then we'll have the time signal. We have to end. Then it's EastEnders. I shall have to go. I thought we were all friends here. So this gives an opportunity for each group to share with other groups what you've been working on, what have been the products, the emergence, the questions, the insights, the story of your journey. But you don't, please don't give a complete recount. That will take another hour for each group. We'll be here at 3 o'clock in the morning before we finish. But really select from it what is appropriate to share in open space. And listen across the groups. So it's so easy for each group to be concerned with its own area and then do its thing and not have listened. But each group has the honour of 4 working groups listening to you, picking up the gems that you brought in, the gold that you brought back into the centre, the nuggets. I'm saying with gold rather than diamond, because diamonds are a girl's best friend, and gold is more gender universal. The value that you bring in from the workshop so far, which then is not the end, but the beginning of the next stage, as we look at then the issues of so what. Where do we go from here? What is the action? What are the responsibilities? How do we take it forward in our personal, group, collective, other organisational frames that we work in? So first, 4 groups listening, 1 group sharing. And I'm not going to order it, this. Simply, what feels the appropriate start point, and then what flows in next. Over to you.
Yes, you talked about a journey, and I think in terms of what we got, this is a group of us, which was Anna and Sandra, we kind of got onto a metaphor of a journey, because the kind of question we were discussing was, do we have to hit the wall? And so we kind of got into this idea of driving in a car, and the driving that's done at the moment is looking in the rearview mirror. An awful lot of it is trying to reproduce the road behind in front of us, and particularly assume. And so, and that particularly came out of the idea that kind of people's kind of commitment and conviction about the possibility of eternal progress is because there's been that progress behind. So when you gave them a Malthusian argument 40 years ago, you know, the Green Revolution has proved you wrong. So if you look in the rearview mirror, then you can believe that the road goes on in front. And how do we stop that? And Vic was talking about the lifeboat drill. So we then got very much, we got a bit tired and sort of lost, and sort of the metaphor probably kind of pinning us down as to what would happen if we got out of the car. But particularly, you know, a discussion about, well, you know, how do we get to discussing an alternative to the road ahead that is essentially a mirror image of the road behind. So it's the very fact that we couldn't conceptualise what the discussion would be. Did it mean that the road ended and we got out of the car? Do we just sort of cease driving? Do we get on a bicycle that's like, you know, what? It's sort of, our kind of intellectual road hit a buffer, simply because we didn't feel we had the wherewithal to kind of think, well, what is the alternative to driving by looking in the rearview mirror.
Can I respond slightly to that? There's some work that's being done around metaphor And a very common metaphor in Western culture is about this journey metaphor. There's also place metaphors. So it could be that we actually think of ourselves in one place, and what does the environment look like, or what is it like, rather than using visual metaphors. And so therefore the environment is changing, or our place is changing, a better way of looking at it. And does that give us more insight into what the future might bring?
How do you finish your book?
That was really just throwing out the idea we kind of got started.
Right. So as my other half has started on our group, I'll carry on with theirs. We ended up with a set of peculiar drawings, which was, how do we do a multi-pronged approach to things rather than just go on a single level? We then started to talk about the fact that we may be in a super critical state, and do we do something about it before it goes? And if we need to do something about it before it changes, can we intervene? Which then brought up sort of resilience. We then realised that we were involved in a psychic argument. We kept trying to reduce the problem to something we thought we could overview, rather than stick to the holistic level. So we finally arrived at what problem-solving approaches for complex problems can you get with complexity, and how do we promulgate them so that people can work it out for themselves rather than having to take on trust? That's what we've got to.
And that connects with another part of the conversation we were having, which was very much about starting where people are and starting. So is that multi-level? So although we were talking about the kind of general direction, we were also talking about actually when you work with people, actually you need to get to where they are. And we did start to kind of play around with what would be the equivalent of 5 a day and better for their health, that's got people to start thinking differently about what they put inside them in terms of food. So the little, what would be the equivalent that would connect with people around the environmental issues, around kind of climate change issues, so that actually people can connect quite easily. So it's not some big, complex, massive
carbon
problem. It's those kind of things. It's those, what are the really simple things at the same time as looking at the macro?
So this is the stories that one might engage with.
Mm-hmm.
Well, perhaps I should say, and I'm not adding anything, I'm just saying something about my impression. Here's a whole group of people who are associated one way or another with an academic life, an academic way of thinking, who've been thinking about this problem much more than the general population outside, and I didn't find talking to anyone that anyone felt that they had a way through or particular areas which could be so explored that there was a definite end in sight. I wouldn't say there was pessimism, but in talking around, and you know, being critical of the group here, perhaps even critical of myself, but I didn't seize on anything which seemed to me to be a really magic way forward. I don't know what that means in future. We all seem to be, maybe there's no way out, but we're terribly impressed with the size of the problem, both in scientific terms and in terms of motivating society to come to some successful conclusions.
But there's one of the reasons for that, because most of the discussion is that
is the solution is simple. I mean, if you read, the solution is simple. You know, get into a reduction in carbon is something you can. The external use spells out steps, and so I mean, the public discussion says there is a solution. We can do it. And one of the part of the pessimism is the sort of sense, well, and most people here don't think it's nearly that simple.
No.
But how do you actually? Are you even allowed to have the discussion publicly? It isn't that simple.
Can we do it? Yes, we can. Will we do it? Probably not.
Do we understand what it is?
Yeah.
Yes.
Other groups coming in, I'm concerned that we give space for those who have not yet spoken and then develop more into the discussion of the stuff that develops out of the whole building. Well, I'm not being a policeman, stopping responses like that.
We started out as part of a very large group that split into two.
Why did you do that?
Well, I think it would... I think the decision kind of emerged collectively that it would be make for perhaps better discussion and a bit more flexibility if we're just smaller groups. Yeah.
I didn't want to pass that over because that felt to me to be a very important moment in the development of the workshop. That eight people found really it wasn't enough space each to be creative and developed a solution. Reflecting on the process, more or less consciously, to do something that enabled better processing. That for me is emergent learning in a group workshop, which you don't see very often. Groups fall and then won't evolve. Brilliant. Thank you.
Well, I mean, I suppose we all eight of us, found some interest to give the critical mass its shape in the first place. And what our half talked about, generally, different aspects of a sense, and I'm summing up for everyone, so please, obviously, come in with other views, but creating a sense of common purpose, broadly speaking, out of an individual's perception of their role in these discourses and facing these challenges. So the kind of taking shape of a sense of common purpose, one thing that got discussed was the notion of giving people a sense of taking on a task as opposed to working towards or with respect to an incentive, either a sort of more public incentive or perhaps even an internal one, but saying, look, there's a task at hand, something you can take on quite practically. What about that? It was also noted that part of that would probably imply ways to get around usual discourses of incentive, which tend to be very sort of market-based. You know, what's in it for me to do that? What's the benefit to me? And very often those benefits are reduced more or less to economic ones, really. You know, is there going to be a tax break, let's say, if I take this on? Or how much will I save if I do this, or so forth? So trying to sort of find ways around some of those usual discourses was something that concerned us. This sense of common purpose actions, one of the ways it might take shape is promulgating actions as making sense against a background that we are really all in this together somehow. Now that goes wider, obviously. It goes to implications for, I suppose, what community means, what participation means, so forth and so on. And that raises an interesting question about the possibility of modelling a kind of, let's say, picture of community or picture of this sort of interaction. What would, to put it quite grossly maybe, what would an ideal world look like, and how interesting might those models be, how effective or useful those might be. Part of that was also to talk about positive visions for complex and challenging choices, rather than doom and gloom the whole thing, to say, look, you know, is it possible to look at this in a constructive way? The way forward might not be having to swallow whole the vision of the future that's rather dismal, but to say, look, there are new possibilities, and that might be a more positive way to present the whole thing. We also talked, just very briefly, we talked about the role of civil society in contrast to leaving it to government to lead. And also the importance of using contemporary communication technology. Where would that fit in? Because it contributes very quickly to the promulgation of ideas and the speed with which those ideas can take root and have influence. That was noted specifically as an issue that perhaps needs some careful looking at on a very practical level.
We got lost in our discussions, but we have questions if you if you want.
But being lost might be the most creative moment.
Thank you.
I'm serious.
You told me last time when I asked your opinion on it seems to be the only way is taxation, and you told me think outside the box, and I've been thinking in the last.
Outside the box. No signposts outside the box. I told you something very creative is happening.
Probably you also mentioned, which we were discussing here, three of us, democratic emergent visitors contributed. Democratic process might be an obstacle in reacting. You probably mentioned it in your talk as well. Also, the assumption that you know we are like a, well, not to insult anybody, but like a big herd, and we have elected representatives up there. And we kind of assume they know, they have access to all the scientists, yeah, like Prime Minister, the cabinet, etc., and they can do the best for us. And they go and talk to other governments in Copenhagen. They search for consensus, which is almost impossible to achieve because conflicts of interest, etc. And then they come back, there is no deal. So as an ordinary member of this herd, what would I feel? Clearly we are not all going to die, otherwise they would have known. I have no access to, do you like this story? I don't know. That's how I feel. Then we were told lobbying might be another way of approaching influencing governments. And we clearly know the negative lobbying from the oil lobby in the United States. And Australian lobby was mentioned in the smoking cessation action in Australia. Apparently it was much before the UK and probably similar time. So we are kind of going around this idea of how can governments take the initiative and make something so people read the signs. We are clearly in some kind of danger and we need to do something about it. At the moment, there is no sign, as far as I can see, from the leadership, you know, our elected leaders.
It's kind of gridlock, isn't it?
It is, isn't it? Yes.
Global power politics.
That's right. And then we talked about this optimization thing. I feel oil, fuel and oil consumption is actually not taxed in this country, it's taxed heavily, but it's actually subsidized. Because if you look at the cost of what might happen in the future, if you take the future into account with the peak oil, it is going for free almost. But then, without providing an alternative way of transport, energy production, how can you really increase the taxation on carbon generating? So there seems to be a dilemma there as well from the managing the crisis from the government's point of view. So that sounds like another question.
Sorry, can you repeat what do you see as the dilemma?
Dilemma from the government's point of view, they can't really increase tax on the carbon producing because they haven't provided an alternative. In fact, they do the opposite. They actually increase the fare for me to come with public transport every year they do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if don't you think also this is a sign that we are not about to disappear into nothingness? You know, from ordinary citizens' point of view, even though I actually feel my personal experience with people, most people believe there is a climate change. But then you look at your government. You know, they have access to all the science and everything, and they what they do is they increase the fare for the public transport.
There's a myth here, is there not, that leadership government has access to information and acts rationally.
Yeah. Assumptions.
Yes,
assumptions.
I wonder if that is our experience of the reality.
Well,
being in a democracy.
Well, it's very comforting, isn't it?
It's
well,
I mean, from normal.
People find that myth very comforting.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That may be
but it
critical.
It's comforting depending on which one it is. So if it dealing with where I am, what it is comforting for me to believe and comforting for me to do, and of course where I am, then I'll believe it. But there might be other circumstances in which you don't believe that. Mm-hmm.
And then my final statement is a little bit joke, but then 4,000 years ago somebody comes and says there's going to be a big flood. I'm looking at you because you seem to be in that position. There is going to be a big flood and nobody believes that person. And well, apparently there was one and there were several floods and people who acted rationally.
There's a much more recent example with the way Gordon Brown treated Alistair Darling, isn't it? He was predicting a severe recession. And what did you say? The hounds of hell got leashed from number 10.
Mrs. Noah and I are building an ark in the
yes.
park.
We are on board.
And pears are invited.
Yes.
Pears
apple,
are
apples.
Are
not something against our group of five.
So it wasn't a wild guess that you might know.
Yeah, I think one of the cross-cutting issues that we raised and I mentioned earlier on was the idea of faced with these intractable political obstacles, how does one provide incentives to change behaviours? To what extent is it possible to rely on positive economic incentives, change behaviours and consumption patterns, etc.? And to what extent is it necessary to issue mandates from above, which ties into those. So, what sort of combination of stick and carrot is necessary, whether it's in the Amazon rainforest or in Western car markets.
This is so fundamental to the agenda of the LSE. Society or economics,
mm-hmm.
psychology, or government, politics, of environment, of energy, decision making, of motivation. And maybe the myth that the action from on high could be carried out, and yet somehow they are defended from the information that would enable them to make the decisions to do that. There are so many constraints.
Politicians make political decisions.
They do indeed.
Not necessarily informed by scientific investigations.
Mm. So that the 2 degrees target in Copenhagen Accord, we have already missed it.
That's right.
And this is a political target, it's not scientific at all.
You're pleased about that.
Because current concentrations are much higher, but it's gone, we've missed the train.
And the
we're still talking about one and a half degrees or 2 degrees.
I'm going to get sucked into this very quickly. that's not my role, I think,
yes,
at this moment.
I think it's one more. There's one more group.
Yeah, I think so.
We, please join in.
Yeah.
We started talking about scales of people. In other words, what numbers are effective when it comes to making decisions and making changes. And there was this idea that sort of up to 15 people is quite an effective group. And then when you get beyond that, there's a certain amount of inertia because people are starting to develop different ideas. And that led into the discussion about some new research that sort of up to 200 is quite good in a loose network. So you can have 15 people in quite a tight network within a slightly looser network of 200. But then any more than that, there was an example of a company that followed this model, and once the numbers got greater than 200, they would actually split up. And this company was very, very successful working on that model. So we were talking about that. Then we actually got on to talking about, with regard to transition, three types of people. Do you want to expand on that?
It's a report. I think I've read it too many recently, but I think it was in one called Pleasure Town Green, which was looking at work that's been done on effective ways of communicating environmental messages. And it was arguing that there are three primary types of people who are trying to communicate with, and there are pioneers, who are people who you know, independently go and do the research and come to their conclusions and maybe start environmental organisations and that kind of thing. And then there are home builders who just settlers who, you know, want to have their home and their family and they want them to be safe and they just want to be left alone and get on with their life. And then there are they call prospectors, which are people who are very aware of prestige and want to be seen to be important and doing worthwhile work and highly valued. And that many environmental organisations, if not all, are started by pioneers for these reasons, which is the smallest group within society. But then their communications tend to appeal only to other pioneers. They can say, hey, look, here's all the evidence, and you know, we really need to take this seriously, and let's get on with it. But then also, as these organisations get older, maybe the originators move on, they're often then led by networkers, because they like the prestige of being the head of Greenpeace or whatever it is. And so they come in and often put the noses out of joint of the original founders who feel that they're not really being true to the original things, and probably get more involved with, say, government and business and getting involved with a wider set of beliefs, because that's the way that they function. But the key thing that I'm trying to do in my particular transition town is in all our messaging when we're doing a poster for an event, is try and be aware to speak to each of these different types of perspectives. And as we were saying, it's not just a set of people. I think all of these things probably exist within all of us, but trying to speak to those different perspectives and not just to one or two of those is quite an important thing in our messaging.
And then we just finished with we were starting to talk about, on a sort of personal level really, conflict. How do you live with the tension of feeling that there is a shred of hope left, but we have to act now, versus just a feeling of despair and that it's already too late? And how do you live with that tension?
I think for me, it's not so much despair. It's if you realistically look at the evidence and you do come to the conclusion that not just for climate science reasons but also for sociological reasons and the reasons of the speed of cultural change is possible, if you do come to the conclusion that it's no longer feasible for us to avoid unstoppable runaway climate change, if that's the case, then where does that leave you? Because if we are beyond that point, if even, you know, the IPCC and mainstream voices like that start saying, right, we're past that point, there's nothing we can do about it anymore, the positive feedbacks are outstripping anything that humans are doing, then we're still alive and we're still in this world and life is still meaningful and we still have choices to make about, you know, whether to act in a loving way or a cruel way or whatever else. And how does that change things? And I have this fear in me that just at the point where our society is starting to get to the point of thinking about carbon and emissions and things like this in almost everything that happens, it might be that just as the culture sort of waking up to that, we get to the point where it actually doesn't make any difference anymore because human emissions are an insignificant part of the picture. And, you know, just as culture catches up, the reality has sort of moved on already. For me personally, there's one part of me that sort of thinks, oh, that really does look like the most probable outcome. There's another part of me that says, but if there's just a tiny chance of avoiding that, we have to give everything we've got to it. And I find in my own life that I have to, everything I do has to be something that feels meaningful to both parts of me, really. And I'm kind of living with that tension in me. I don't think it's something you can resolve, really, and just say, I believe this or I believe that. But I do find that I couldn't do anything that just ignored one side or the other of that dichotomy.
I heard what I thought was a very helpful and memorable quotation the other day by Louis Theroux's brother. He said, there is always this difficulty in trying to figure out if the glass is half full or half empty. Maybe what we need to do is just get a glass half the size. the thought of changing glass has been a very, very sort of intriguing and positive one for me recently.
Outside the box.
I have a sneaking feeling that glasses have a tendency to be half full or half empty, whatever they are. Yeah, okay. That feels like a gathering. Now, as you reflect on that, what stands out as requiring further engagement? And to hold the shadow as well, what have we missed and why?
Well, something that I thought was worth raising and relates to what Sean was just saying about whether to feel despair or not, if you come to the conclusion that runaway climate change is going to happen. Well, I thought that the interesting thing about bringing together Chris Martinson and David Wasdell's presentations was that we understood the two sides of the energy problem, and the fact is that the kind of changes we need to make to be prepared for peak oil hitting are pretty much exactly the changes we need to make to try and stop runaway climate change. So if we fail to stop runaway climate change, we are still preparing ourselves for dealing with very imminent shocks. And so in a similar way to Sean, I've kind of reconciled myself to thinking, well, as long as I'm working on something that will be useful to us, whether or not we succeed in stopping runaway climate change, this preparation is useful.
Something on that I came up with when I was writing my book was looking at different scenarios and the idea that the resilient approach is the one that's useful across the widest possible range of scenarios. Made me think that resilience is humility in action, really. It's saying, actually, I don't know what's going to happen, but I'm going to do the best thing. And that really helped me because I've always thought humility was quite an important concept, but I'd never really tied it to resilience before. And that was a nice insight for me.
I always worry about the kind of tying climate change and peak oil together, because addressing peak oil almost inevitably runs down the alternative energy kind of replacement of existing sources of energy with more energy, rather than more dramatic solutions. You know, so if you engage with the peak oil, if the kind of peak oil debate is what orders your thinking, you're going to be thinking about very much more of the same, but how do we do it? How do we just do the same but do it differently?
Why not energy demand reduction? Mm-hmm. Is there a response to people?
Because I think in terms of, I don't know, I just, that's where I find the debate goes, I guess. But I mean, I agree with you that it's energy demand reduction is at a, but I think the problem is that the energy, if you're just talking about energy, then you don't talk about total, this kind of, the kind of total issues, and I think I mentioned when you were talking earlier that slide that Tim Jackson had when he was talking here, showing that actually, if you look at the different ecological impacts of human activity, then the climate change is actually rather far behind things like biodiversity loss in terms of sort of measures of sustainability or unsustainability. So again, so that focus about on energy, so just which I think peak oil inevitably makes you do. Just I can see you're not convinced less of that.
My sense is that the elephant is beginning to show itself. What other perspectives have we got that might help us to understand?
Well, I don't know if these are the elephants you're thinking of, but what I noticed as I was sitting here is that hardly anybody mentioned business. Maybe that's not me listening very well, but I think there was a lot about government policy and getting governments to do that, and getting governments to persuade people, getting governments, individuals to act, but very little about business and organisations, and I think that's a huge issue.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a sense, and this may not be correct, that many of the people here are interested in policy and getting governments to do things, and fewer of us are actually working at the grassroots level trying to do that sort of stuff, and I think that's a real shame, because I think you need both, and you can't possibly be devising policies if you don't know what the experience of those at the grassroots trying to do what that is like. So I've sort of felt, you know, I'd like to take some practical things away from me for what I'm trying to do, and I feel there's actually, frankly, very little. It's not much use to me that somebody might influence government and there might be some policy in 2-3 years down the line. That's not much practical use to me.
Mm-hmm.
right now. And again, I still feel, partly the reason I'm on this journey is just because it's fun. I mean, I'm having the time of my life. It's amazing. And being in London, the people I meet, the connections you can make, the sense of things happening at all sorts of different levels is just phenomenal. And so this whole thing that innovation, creativity and passion is just fundamental for me, and I just don't get a sense of that yet. And I would really like to be part of some group, because that's just where I am, and it's just fun. It's really challenging, it's hard work, but it is just amazing. Yeah. So those are my...
I think there's an interesting point to follow from that. Does anyone else want to say
something? I'm sure that look, this is just beginning to bubble.
I think it's very important what you were saying, Anna, about it against the councils of despair. The point is that once people start doing some things, then they can do more. And so in that sense, to tie back to the kind of some of the policy initiatives, I mean, if across Europe they pushed harder the regulations on engine sizes for cars, which they progressively they are doing. I mean, every year they kind of there was a reducing target for total fleet from each manufacturer in terms of emissions. I mean, that could be done much more dramatically, and then people would just sort of think, well, I have a smaller car now. And if people knew that they had a smaller car, they'd think, I'm doing something about it. And so you start believing that something was happening and that we were all part of it. Because for most people, they don't experience anything happening. I mean, the thing about government would do something, and I've had a lot of people saying in discussions that I've sat and listened to, well, if it was real, if it was as bad as they say it is, of course they'd do something. Which is kind of rather astonishing. But a lot of people do say that.
Mm.
So it says, if something was happening and I was part of it, so I knew I couldn't buy the car that I might have wanted to buy 2 years ago, I might start believing something. But that's it. So start with something and get it moving.
Mm-hmm. I think there's a sort of collective on being aware of the myth about government.
Mm.
As a kind of almost a trance state, a hypnotic trance state that we're falling into. If it's really bad, they will do something.
Mm.
They haven't, so it can't be really bad.
And they never did throughout history either.
Until a bomb actually dropped.
Well, until it's actually...
But even then, so...
Change comes from below.
There's something about a collective trance state in the face of an anxiety that is palpable. And the greater the anxiety becomes, the more this myth that somebody somewhere must know about it is going to do something. It's almost an abdication into this dream world. And I'm wondering how the psychology of the hypnotic dream state relates to the political inability to act and the naivety that thinks that it's easy for government to take that kind of action at any level, in the immensely polarized world of extraordinarily powerful vested interests,
mm-hmm.
for whom not acting on climate change is survival for the bottom line, and who will do anything possible in order to prevent real action being taken in this crisis. And governments are caught in the moment of impotence, and we don't challenge it because we have this myth of dependence. Something like that is what I'm picking up from the kind of collective exploration of the elephant that prevents things happening. Can you help me further with this?
There's something worse, actually. Our inability to obviously change. We stick to our lifestyles. And that's what governments also try to protect and preserve. Because if
you challenge that, they would not be able to.
Exactly. You know, we are prepared to... To me, Iraq war was entirely about protecting our lifestyle, which is a fuel consuming CO2 generating lifestyle. I mean, I was devastated because to protect your lifestyle, you are prepared to kill millions. I mean, it's absolutely horrifying. And we are talking about to change that lifestyle in a radical way, which shows us how difficult that's going to be.
You made a point earlier that I thought was very helpful in this regard. Because climate change is something, I think, generally speaking, that pretty much everyone is aware of. But it's not just a question of government. There are repeated signals that there are other things that are actually more important for us as ordinary individuals to be worried about. Even things that are, in their own terms, relatively complex and specialised, such as, you know, the inflation rate is running at about 3.something%. People get far more excited about the thought of, gosh, what's that going to do to my savings, than they do about, yes, very well, we need to tackle climate change. So I don't think it's just government as such to maybe fill this out a bit. It's that there is a sort of collective impression that, yes, it's out there as one of many issues, but at the end of the day, right, things like the impact on my savings and whether or not the economy is going to turn around and X, Y, Z, they come much closer to home, I think, than climate change does sometimes, frankly.
I think this is part of the problem that this group's been trying to address in terms of complexity.
Mm.
People do not think systems. They do not see the economy as being the collapsing canary
that's
cooling the coal mine. And we try to have a system. We don't teach system thinking.
Mm.
We don't think in terms of system.
Mm.
When we talk about the government, we see it as up there.
Right.
It's part of the system in which we're in. And we try to shave it down into small problems. Let's talk about the economy. Let's talk about peak oil. Not. Let's talk about the system.
And George Marshall made a point here that he was saying that climate change has been seen as an environmental issue. It was first talked about at Rio and reported on by environmental correspondents, but it's the biggest economic issue, it's the biggest human rights issue, but it's not seen as those organisations as their business because it's an environmental issue. And I think also underlying this is our sort of cultural myths and things like Hollywood movies that tell us that the solution to a huge problem, you know, you've got this huge, unstoppable, overwhelmingly powerful force, and what stops it is the hero pushing really hard, you know. that's what overcomes things. And I think, you know, I was in a couple of meetings with Ed Miliband just before and just after Copenhagen, and I think he tried really hard to be that hero. He really did. He went there desperately, gave everything he could, and drove himself into the ground in an attempt to reconcile economic growth and limits to growth and climate change and that is beyond the capacity of a human being, and it just is, and there are forces which are greater than that story that tells us that you just have to be heroic and you can achieve anything isn't actually useful in this particular circumstance. In many circumstances it's very useful, but we need a diversity of stories about things like collective action and like, you know, stepping back and looking at things in a systems perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Those aren't fed to us through our main cultural outlets, and I think that's a big part of our problem.
That links up with some private conversations going on in the afternoon about leadership and the search for the guru, the messiah, the charismatic leader. And I think what you just put your finger on there is that charismatic leadership, the messianic guru type leadership, is incapable of solving this kind of problem, but does develop and seduce followership in a passive, you know the way, I'll follow you, absolutely vitiates distributed intelligence, parallel processing, and collective complexity. But I will just, I don't like taking issue with you, but I think I will raise for examination that the problem itself is beyond human capacity. I think as a collective, in complex, multiple parallel processing, we do have the meta-humanoid capacity to deal with complex issues. It's just impossible to do it in that way. So I would raise that again. And in our final 5 minutes, I take it really there's nothing to be done beyond the boundary of today, or is there? What do you feel? What is emerging that says, hey, I wish we could take this further, and it means this or that initiative to do so? Is anything coming to mind along those lines? Or has this been a lovely workshop and two seminars and okay, the complexity group will go on, but we have done our job. Where are we at? I'm taking the temperature.
David, we have the possibility of a workshop coming up with Bob Horn, I think.
Yes, on the 15th.
On the 15th. I certainly would like to feel that extra input coming in that would give an extra motivation with his input of deep, basically, as I understand it, is deconstructing back from a possible future, but that would give us some insights to get our heads around and motivate future discussion.
Mm-hmm.
Apart from that, we're complete enough within the boundary. There's nothing to require action at a personal or group or other level beyond us as a result of our work together.
There's plenty of personal.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, let's name it. Do it. Come on. You've got 4 minutes left. What's requiring action?
I was going to find more
about that initiative is how we fall straight into the trap of waiting for someone to outside to come in with yet more resources, which is how groups, people, individuals, our governments, we're always waiting for something next to just get us going,
mm-hmm.
rather than go with what we've got in sort of not quite finished fashion.
But my sense was maybe you've just taken us back again because we were just getting to the busy bits that wanted to happen. And I can say that to you because you can deprive me of my tea later.
No tea.
I've got glass.
I withdraw everything that I just said.
I think one of the strongest things that came out of this discussion for me, though I don't know as a very newcomer how well it would fit in with the context of the complexity group, is this idea of the, it's very psychological actually, the personal experience of anxiety over these questions,
yeah.
how this translates or not into choices and perspectives and so forth, both on the macro level, yes, in terms of policy and whatever, but the closest to her micro level too. I mean, this is, we talk about this all the time, I mean, you know, recycling everything. I mean, these are deeply individual personal choices, and I think there's an awful lot of anxiety perspectives behind it will be very, very interesting to explore, I think. The real personal experience of some of these issues.
What format would you really like to design that would enable you and some with you to address that? What would it look like?
Gosh.
It feels slightly different from this.
Is it not the subsector of the psychology issues?
Mm.
Strikes me. You know, the issue, and it comes back to whether we need to be afraid or pessimistic, you know, that seems to sit in that.
That's conceptually. I was actually asking dynamically. What
yeah.
does it look like?
I have to say, I don't have a clear picture in my mind of
okay,
what it looks like.
You.
Yeah.
Thank you. That's critical to take forward, and I think Kate, we have some sense of the priority of that as an emergent area.
But again, I just doesn't help me. I have crucified my academic career because of my increasing involvement in climate change issues. My contract finishes next Wednesday and I have a six-year-old. I have no doubt that what I'm doing is right and important and I'm having fantastic fun with it. Who is going to pay me to do it? And nobody is raising this issue and it's all, oh, we'll have this policy and we'll enable people and we'll all hold hands and it will be lovely maybe. But you know, those of us who are really working at the grassroots have this fundamental challenge that you need somebody to be out there, you need lots of us out there, sticking our heads above the parapet, working away, slaving away, doing stuff, trying stuff out. And that is work.
Yes. Okay. That is.
And it's so important that this message is heard.
Yes. And it's
because if you want to have. Yeah. Yeah.
But yes, and the word action also has extraordinary diversity. You know, we take action, it means we have a million people on the street and we shout. No, that's not action, for God's sake. It makes no bloody difference whatsoever. Because we shout at the deaf walls and they do nothing.
So what you're talking about is work.
Yes. And it's fun.
Aye.
But it's
but
work.
It is work and it requires immense engagement. I have a moment to share with you. Club of Rome. End of small presentation. Comment. This is a call to arms for the Club of Rome. Excuse me. Snip has a call to arms. It's a call to work. So let's rewrite the master lay, please. It's not aux armes citoyens. Say, à travail citoyen. To get work going right the way through in a complex, phase change, multi-million, diversified, parallel processing, creative emergence of a collective response to a challenge which is incapable of being engaged in the power processes that at the moment are power processes of impotence and controlled by vested interests with you. Okay, we have a job to do.
And my concern is that more psychological work will not of itself enable that change unless there are other processes, things happening that people can then go and do. Otherwise you're exposing people to hell and there's nothing they
and
can
the
do.
The myth of on itself, I don't think you're missing out
no,
work
no.
And I don't believe you're missing out psychology.
Yes,
no, no. I'm holding both at this
yes,
stage.
Yes,
of this.
Yes.
Yes.
But
yes.
I'm just
because after all, if someone despairs, they might rule out opportunities for involvement that might really exist, actually,
yeah.
At the grassroots level, at whatever level, to take their energy and try and apply it. If they think they're on, if despair has got better of them,
yeah.
Then what's the incentive even to explore? Do you see what I mean?
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Now, I'm aware of the time boundary, my commitment to close and hand back to you, Eve. I would like 30 seconds just for the closing comment from myself and then back, is that acceptable? To take part in this has been a privilege. Thank you. It raises so much in the content and even more in what was not brought into the content. I'm aware that in the first part of my presentation was buried a paradigm shift in the analysis of the climate change diagnosis, which has the most extraordinary implications right across the globe at the moment. And it has been almost impossible to engage that agenda. My sense is it is so terrifying and the implications are so massive that it is the rogue elephant that is outside the room, let alone the elephant that is in the room, and heffalumps and horrible horribles and all that jazz. So I work with that and I think, how on earth can we deal with the reality of what is happening on earth and stay with it, hold each other, to stay in touch with the diagnosis that then leads to the solution? Because if we abort the diagnosis because we don't look at it, we come up with solutions that don't deal with the problem. And that is my fear that has come out of the process of today. Eve, back to you.
Thank you very much. Actually, it's been quite an amazing afternoon. And I'd just like to pick up some